आलू घुसेगा उस साइड से सोना निकलेगा।
Hi, this is episode 54 of Attention Plus right here on Talking Stuff Network. I'm Vikram Mohan. We are recording this on the 1st of September, India time. And as we wind down the monsoons in India and the summer in the US, here we have entered the festive season, kicking it off with Ganesh Chaturthi. So Ganesh Chaturthi wishes to all of you. And festival for me, inevitably, it just means food and gorging on lots and lots of it. I'm pretty sure I'm going to gain a few kilos by the time the year is done. Unfortunately, food seems to have been intertwined with religion and new ways of late. And what with the Zomato controversy and then McDonald's, KFC, their halal only stance being in the news. So let's ask our host Arnab what he thinks of it. Hey Arnab, let me ask you this. Was food always political, or is this something new?
I mean, anything is political. Aristotle famously said that man is a political animal, which the way Aristotle explained it was that ever since man had the power of speech, it's not something political, at least according to Aristotle. You know, being a political animal isn't inherently encoded in our DNA. Again, Aristotle wouldn't know what DNA is, but he didn't say that it was a fundamental intrinsic property of humanity. But he said that it was a property of our being able to speak. The fact that we can, you know, speak our thoughts inherently makes us political animals. So given that, it stands to reason that the other thing that, you know, we use our mouth for, which is food, it is also inherently political. It has always been. The food has always been political. Vegetarianism in India has been political, for instance. And the Sepoy Mutiny, again, for those of you who know our history, it comes from food. It comes from prohibited food. So of course, food is political, and there's no denying it. And anybody who would deny it is obviously living in a fool's paradise.
Okay. Honestly, as somebody who loves pepperoni, and I don't want to get in trouble, but I don't think any food is banned in Hyderabad yet. I love all kinds of meat, and I am kind of disappointed that, you know, I don't get one or the other in most places. So yeah, I just wish you know, things were a lot better, at least for people for foodies like me. But let's move on to less controversial topics.
No, but let's discuss this a little bit. So
okay, sure.
It's a fallacy that in, let's say, in the US, you can eat anything you want. For instance,
you can't have horse meat. I think
you can't have horse meat. So every country, and maybe we will return to this again and again in this podcast, but we have to understand that our freedom always comes. So in an ideal situation, in an ideal society, you would say, why do we, you know, what prevents us from eating anything we want? And from a purely logical perspective, that's true. I mean, in the US, why shouldn't I be allowed to have horse meat? Or why shouldn't I be, I don't know if it's legal in the US, but obviously, you cannot go to your local grocery and get dog meat, for instance. While it's you know, markets in Vietnam, you know, there's a lines of stores selling dog meat. Now, it's another thing whether I would ever eat dog meat, and the answer to that is a definite no, because of my other beliefs. But again, the fact is, and I wouldn't say it's political. It's maybe it is political in a way, but the point is that in any society, we see that, you know, our freedom, even though we talk about it in absolutes, is that a society has to function based on a certain number of shared values. Now, any modern society, it attempts to strike a balance between points of convergence and points of divergence. And there is no really golden rule as to what we need to agree on and what we need to differ. I've said this before in this podcast that when you salute the flag, the reason why you do that is because if you don't do that, if you do not subscribe to those notions of commonality that is subscribing to the, that is, you know, standing up to the flag, saluting the flag, then you get into a position where you're basically, the commonality is based on your religion, which history has shown that while it is natural for people to use religion as a form of mobilizing and of defining their community, it's the surest way to conflict and strife. Because the problem with religion is it's not inclusive, while nationhood is inclusive. That's the big difference between saluting an Indian flag and saluting the Islamic flag or saluting the Bhagwa flag. That's the difference, because there is the nation is by fundamentally, because you know people from outside can become citizens, and but then what, how do you become part of the community? And this is where food comes in, because food is, it's like what I believe, what I, you know, it's ultimately it's inside me, right? So unless I'm on social media and I'm, you know, explicitly saying what I believe, I can choose to believe what I want. I can choose to have what I do within the confines of my home, right? Nobody would ever know. But with food, that's the problem, is that we don't produce our own food. We depend on others for food. And so when we depend on others for food, we are essentially expressing our political opinion through food by our eating habits. Now, this becomes when the individual has to consider whether it is worth the food or it is worth being part of the community. So every society imposes certain rules, random and arbitrary true, around food. So whether it is beef or whether it is pork or whether it is horse and whether it is often non-veg food in general, there is no doubt that food is one of the things that allow people to form a community. It's because of the smells of food, because of our intimate relationship with food. It is inherently political what you choose to put on your plate. And people will judge you for it, much more, I would say, than people would judge you for some political opinion. I would say, whether you say that I'm, you know, a fan of Modi or I'm a fan of Rahul Gandhi, the depth of judgment that you will get from that, it's much more likely that you'll be more deeply judged on what you put on your plate, especially if you're putting on plate things which people, you know, do not consider to be acceptable in that particular community that you're in. Again, as Singh Vijay said in my podcast long time, it is
right.
What can you do versus what should you do? And it's a judgment which all of us have to make, whether making the point is, or keeping my individuality is worth the cost of detaching ourselves from that community. And again, it's a personal judgment and everybody has to take what works for them.
Well, do you want to go deeper into this rabbit hole? I have a couple of questions for you.
Yes, please do.
Okay. Now, let's break down this food controversy itself. I mean, from news point of view, there were two major stories. The first one was, of course, you spoke of the, you know, Sepoy mutiny or the First War of Independence, as we call it, which actually brought together the Hindus and Muslims because the cartridges were greased with both beef and pork. Now, similarly, you know, after a long time, you had both Hindus and Muslims protesting together, and this time it was the employees of Zomato who said they would not carry, they are being forced to deliver food which is either pork or beef. Now, I'm not sure where I stand with this. I mean, I'm not a religious person myself, but what do you make of it? I mean, on one hand, it's their job to, that nobody's forcing them to eat it. I don't know. I'll leave it to you. What's your take on this one?
So, for this, the solution is pretty easy. If you feel that carrying food that you do not particularly approve of because of your religion or because of your morality, you're free to take another job. Because this is part and parcel of the job. If you're in food delivery is your job. So this is essentially, it's not the state. Okay. So it's much more murky when it's the state forcing you to do something versus when it's your job forcing you to do something, because you do have the freedom to choose another job. So if something does not, if for instance, you know, many pharmaceutical products are tested on animals. Now, if you have a problem with that, just don't work for a company that does animal testing. If you feel strongly about that, but you cannot expect that the company will change its policy because of you. Unless, of course, you're the CEO and you sit in a position of power that allows you to make that change. But for normal employees, the company cannot be expected to change their business model on these grounds for the employee. And I mean, that's the way it is. So for the food deliverers to complain about the food that they're delivering, the solution is pretty simple. You know, do something else, deliver packages.
Yeah, become an Amazon delivery and hope yes. that so nobody's ordering something which you don't like.
Yes, and then somebody could say, look, I really hate Apple. I'm not going to deliver Apple iPhone. Only Android, please. So again, where are you going to stop?
True. I don't like Loki. If somebody's ordering Loki, I won't deliver that.
Sure.
Okay, the other one, of course, is not as simple, right? I mean, this is the halal controversy has been raging on and off across the world several times. And now most recently, what's happened is, I don't know why suddenly people woke up to the fact now that all the major chains serve only halal meat. For me, if you ask me, it's a question of economics. Let's say 15 to 20% of your customers will only eat if it's halal. Rest of it, honestly, don't give a damn. But the other side of it is, by serving only halal, you're in fact putting in place a religion-based reservation system on the entire meat delivery, or rather in the meat industry. So, of course, we had the Hindu right wing saying that we need to boycott these chains. And of course, we had some inconsistent stands again on the left as well, saying that, no, this is good. They would be against a religion-based, quota system anywhere else. But apparently, it's okay in this case. So, I've found gross inconsistencies in both ends.
So, I think the problem comes from the fact that what has been accepted for so long. So, for so long, for years, we have accepted that religion is allowed to discriminate. So, We have accepted that, for instance, that Sabarimala, being a religious organization, is allowed to discriminate. Religion is a private club. So if it's a private club, if it's a private institution, they get to decide who they let in, that members are allowed, and they define rules as to who is allowed entry and who is not allowed entry. But over the years, we have seen that religious places are considered to be places that are by default open for the public. So the very nature of it is not considered a private place. It is not considered like your home. So for your home, you are allowed to decide who you're going to let in, who you're not going to let in. But temples and mosques and whatever, they're supposed to be. So we're kind of introspecting. And of course, some people would claim that the introspection is more on Hindu religious practices. And there is some truth to that. So once we have decided to open that Pandora's box, so as to say, then other things, of course, need to pass through the same scrutiny. And it's very right to say that is halal something? Is the very practice that, there's no doubt that halal, the very nature of halal is that the food cannot be handled by non-Muslims. That is, it's not just a technique for slaughter. It's also a technique as to who does the slaughter. And that is inherently discriminatory and based on religion. And I think the question is, and the question is definitely right to raise whether that's, and I don't know. I mean, I would like to see it stand up to, a judicial, for somebody to bring it up to court, really. If somebody feels strongly that, I am not a Muslim, but I want to get into the halal business. And why am I being discriminated? I think there's a fairly decent ground for a court challenge on that. But short of that happening, again, it's just, see, India's secularism, what we have, like the Nehruvian notion of secularism is rather pragmatic, but it does not stand to logical scrutiny. There are double standards. There are double standards that have been accepted as a cost for pluralism. So it's unfortunately that when you, and I'm using air quote liberals over here, when you corner them with argument, this is really what they should say. They should say, look, I mean, I understand that I cannot argue with you on the grounds of pure fairness, but the thing is, because of reasons of pragmatism, we have to do this. If you don't do it, then the nation will split. And we will be fighting over things we don't need to fight. Okay, so halal is going on. Who's being harmed? Nobody. If you try to have a court challenge, if you bring it up to court, the only person who will gain from this is Arnab Goswami, really, because you will have a lot of material to do shows on for the next year. Other than that, why bring up something which is there's no good that can come out of it? Right? There's not a line of Hindu young men and women who want to go into the butchery business, right? So how does this help? This only opens up fault lines. So from a notion of pragmatism, yes, but from a notion of pure debate, the kind of things that we in social media and even this podcast kind of delights in is, what if, you know, what if we apply the same standards to these guys? What would happen then? From that perspective, yes, that's why I say a court challenge would be interesting. It would be interesting to me, but it would not necessarily be good for the country, which again brings me to this part, what should be done and what could be done. They're often two distinct things. And as I grow older, and my daughter grows older, I realize, and I become more a parent, I realize that there is a difference between the two. That there are some things in which, you know, if I want to argue and debate about it, of course, I will win the argument. But then there is the question of, should I even get into this argument? And is it really worth it? So these things have to be balanced. And as a parent, you realize that there are a lot of arguments you don't want to get into with your kid, because it's not just not going to lead anywhere. And similarly, for a country, there are just a lot of debates. We could be fighting among ourselves 24/7 on different issues. But rather than doing that, let's do things like the economy. Let's do the things that really, really impact our lives rather than halal.
Different side note though, on a couple of years ago, I caught myself using the "because I said so" logic as a parent. And that's when I realized that, you know what, I think life has come a full circle. But yeah, moving on, our second topic is no less controversial, and it's probably, it's occupying at least all the front page in right here in India for the past few weeks. And that's about the irrefutable fact that the GDP growth has shrunk. And again, there are people arguing whether there is an actual recession coming or not. So you do have a little bit of economist blood in you, Arnab. So, that makes you more qualified than many of the people who are sitting in the small boxes on Times Now or Republic. So,
but in this country, you're right. In this country, we have decided as a country that blood matters. So we have decided that Abhishek Bachchan gets to act because his dad was a great actor. Or we decide that Rahul Gandhi gets to rule because his great-granddad gave us independence. So since we have all accepted this, at least some of us have accepted this, I hope that, you know, my listeners will be forgiving and allow me the ajgar jurrat of talking about economics based on both my dad as well as my mom. Both on my mother is a master's in economics from University of Rochester.
Okay. I didn't know that.
Yes, and my dad is a PhD from the same place. So, I get this from both sides. So again, let's just talk about the economic slowdown. And forgive me if I say something wrong, because I'm not an economist. This is based on common sense and some reading, and I could be wrong. So. Again, this
you're
is
the Yuvraj of economics.
Yes, I'm the Yuvraj of economics. And again, when I say this, I realize that nobody nowadays, like not in Arnab Goswami or anybody, I don't think anybody ever says, like I have Nidhi Razdan and all these people, they're all commenting about this without ever an apology that, you know, I don't really know the subject. And nobody really says that. So we have this, you know, this viral video of our latest Max Essay winner talking about economics, and obviously he knows everything, and he doesn't. And of course, we accept that as a fact, because if you don't, then dar ka mahol hai. So we will accept that that's also correct. But moving on, let's look at this. This is an important thing, because I think that rather than halal meat, as I said, the important thing is the state of the economy. It's important because it affects all of us. Now, It's obvious that there's no escaping the fact that India's GDP growth has slowed down. But straight off the bat, when people, and this is, I found this difficult sometimes to wrap my mind around it, when people say, look at the GDP growth under Manmohan Singh and look at the GDP growth under the previous NDA government under Vajpayee, you have to understand that the GDP growth, you're starting from the base. The base is important. So when you're a smaller economy, obviously you're going to grow at a faster rate. It's the balloon effect, right? When the balloon's small, the balloon expands at a faster rate. And when the balloon becomes full of air, the rate of increase is lower. So if you look at the US economy, it grows glacially, 1%, 2%, I think, because the US economy is just that much bigger. It's impossible for the US economy almost disobeys the laws of physics in the world of economics if it grows at, say, 7%, 8%, 9%? Because it just cannot, because it's already so big. So we also have to accept that as India becomes, you know, our GDP grows. Now, there's a point that if it's, you know, that really what we should be tracking is per capita GDP rather than GDP itself. That's another issue. But the fact is that the GDP growth as such cannot sustain itself. And it's kind of a false maths to compare a current GDP growth rate, which is a growth rate, with something which happened 5 years ago. They're just not comparable. So I was like, again, just listening to some of the news programs and trying to figure out what people were saying and what I agree with them and what kind of stands the test of common sense. So one thing that we have to realize is that the world is actually, you know, according to many experts, and I'm not one of them, is on the verge of a recession. That some of the recession, again, there is obviously business cyclical trends, rather. But there's also the trade war that Trump has launched on China. Now, I'm not fully sure that is to India's disadvantage. I think that if manufacturing moves out of China or might move out of China, India stands to gain from that. So again, with international developments for that, even if you say, oh, the world is doing badly, we are doing badly, it's also not as simple as that. This also is as simplistic an argument as expecting that your GDP growth will be the same or will exceed what it was 5 years ago or 6 years ago, even 10 years ago. It's just not possible. So if you look at the Indian economy, I think the current real problem is because of a problem of liquidity. There's just not money to borrow. People are just sitting on their money. So we have a liquidity crunch. And for those of you, and again, it's, I'm pretty sure all of you guys know this better than I do. But for those of you who don't, the unlucky few, the cash is the most liquid thing. I mean, if you have 100 rupees and you want to go and buy timatar, you have 100 rupees, you get the timatar immediately. But if you don't have 100 rupees and you have 100 rupees worth of apples and you want to buy tomatoes, then you have a problem, because, you know, what is the value given to those apples? So the problem right now that India has is that we have, and business works on credit, right? So it's not that business has cash lying around. So you have things out in the market based on prospected profits or revenue. You take more money to be able to finance yourself today. That's all. Pretty much everybody knows that it's not like that. You produce goods, you sell it, you make the profit, you get the money, and then you start doing the next round of production. And if you do that, then of course, you'll never be able to produce anything. So any kind of economic activity involves taking loans from people or from banks. And what has happened is that the confidence of people who loan money and that people will actually return them has gone down. And that is because of our nationalized banks' non-performing assets. So essentially what's happened is that because of political interference in our... So there's a lot of reasons. But one is, of course, political interference. You know, the Mallayas of the world, anybody who's gotten a loan from a nationalized bank knows that there is some amount of khana pina that needs to be done in order for you to get that. So, of course, this is a ascending pyramid. So, if you want to loan to start your garage, then, of course, it's different from if you want to buy an IPL team. So, of course, it varies. And, you know, the amount of pleasing that you have to do obviously varies with it. Now, what's happened is because of the laxity of the system, because of the Congress government's essential turning their back on corruption, because the culture of Congress has been one of corruption on a massive scale. If what has happened is over the years, we have the large sections of the economy, and again, I don't want to make generalizations, have worked on essentially a Ponzi scheme. So people have started companies within real estate or, you know, different domains. They have started businesses. If you look at the whole Chidambaram thing, you know, it's a massive amount of capital infusion coming to INX Media. And what's happened to them now? They're in jail for... So, you know, the massive amounts of crores of money were being raised from the market in those days based on pretty much nothing. What did INX Media really have? Nothing but the amount of capital they raised. Where do you think the capital is gone? Obviously, somebody has defaulted. Somebody has taken the immense monetary slap. Somebody's pocket has been picked. And once your pocket has been picked, you're not going to be in that market giving out money to the next pickpocket who comes along, right? So that's essentially the problem. So the Ponzi scheme, the way it's worked is, again, is that when the times were good, cash flows. So if I have 100 rupees to invest, along comes this guy who comes and says, hey, you give me that 100 rupees and a week from now, I'll give you 1,000 rupees. Now, obviously, this is too good to be true. But I say, you know, why not? Because, you know, I'm in that mood. So I start and I give him 100 rupees. And lo and behold, next week he does give me back 1,000 rupees. Now, how did he give me back 1,000 rupees? Well, he sold that exact same thing to 11 other people. Actually, more than 11 other people, but he sold it more. Everybody gave him 100 rupees. He kept 100 rupees for himself and gave me that 1,000 rupees back. Now I say, man, 100 rupees went to 1,000 rupees. This time, let me give 1,000 rupees. Now you see how the scheme will work. Next, you'll give me, add another zero and give it back to me. And of course, he will, every time in order to sustain this, he needs to increase his base of people who are falling for this. And of course, people don't fall for this because they're stupid. Many of the people who are falling for it are institutional investors and they know exactly what's going on, but they're also in on the cut. So when that guy is saying, you know, he keeps 10 rupees for himself, he also gives 1 rupee back to the guy who took the decision to invest in him. So again, it's a tangled weave. It's a tangled web. He's not making that 10 rupees. 1 rupee is giving to him. 1 rupee is giving chanda to the political party. 1 rupee is giving to the cop. So he's spreading the wealth around. But what that means is there's a lot of cash flow in the whole system. Everybody is, you know, giving money. They're buying things. And the economy, so-called, is booming. You have real estate. You have, you know, Sourav Ganguly selling real estate. You have, you know, Viktor Banerjee selling, you know, hospital services. You have everybody, huge billboards. You know, in Bengal, we have Rose Valley. We have so many of these chit funds. Exactly. There's a lot of money, a lot of credit. You know, people are making, they're getting money. They're giving out money to other people to then invest in similar high-risk ventures. And, of course, they're failing. But the money is still coming, and people are, since they are getting back their money multiplied, they still have confidence in the system. But some people are, again, I don't know better. I think, I don't know, I'd forgotten the name of the guy, but, you know, he said that, you know, essentially when you do day trading, you know, investment is basically making money out of the fools. So that's exactly how this market works. Still, of course, you understand that this cannot sustain itself. That this entire scheme is based on the fact that there will be somebody, you know, in the game of passing the parcel who will be left holding the parcel at the end, which is the non-performing debt, you know, the money that's not going to be paid back. And that sucker has been, I wanted to use the name of a character from Gunda, of course, but
we know which one.
but that sucker is the banks, the nationalized banks. And they're willing suckers, by the way. It's not that they're stupid and they're complicit in it. They knew that they will be held at different levels, of course. But that's exactly what has happened. That because of this confluence of the investors, the banks, the political establishment, that we've had this system and somebody had to take the fall for it. And the BJP, while it is in power, has. Again, we've seen with multiple businessmen, with Nirav Modi. I mean, these things all happen with knowledge. And the political class knows. This is how politicians raise their money. That when this bubble is going on, when this bubble of money, where nothing of real importance is being produced, you see, wealth increases when And this is very similar to the 2008 crisis also. It was very different, but because it was in real estate, the investment was in mortgage-backed securities. But ultimately, the real problem is the same in both cases, that a lot of money is circulating in the economy, making things look like as if they're good, but nothing really productive is being done. And the example is you have Royal, you have RBC as a team. Is it RBC? BRC? What is that? What is the Bangalore?
Royal RCB.
RCB, sure. So you have RCB and you have I'm picking on RCB over here, but you have something of absolute no value being there, which looks good, nice uniform, has some good players, but ultimately is of no value.
I'm going to get some messages about this on WhatsApp.
No, I would have said KKR, by the way, but it has won twice, so I can't.
True.
I really can't, even though I want to, but I can't. I'm sorry. It did win it twice. So, and everybody knows how much I love and hate on KKR, but honestly, it's not a bad franchise in that respect. It's obviously not Mumbai Indians or Chennai Super Kings, but it's after that, I think they have the best record. So, the point is that this is really one of the problems with, and we're paying for it right now. And with the government deciding to consolidate banks, it's a good move because it means that, but it's a good move, but then there's this question, what are we gaining from it? I think Nirmala Sitharaman said that no jobs are going to be lost, if I'm correct. So yeah, essentially,
that's inevitable, right?
It's inevitable, right? If in any company, whenever there's any merger, usually the company which got bought out loses their top management. Now, unfortunately, this is Indian government, so none of them will lose their positions, and now they'll fight among themselves, or they'll be sitting there twiddling their thumbs. This is the problem with having nationalized infrastructure. Obviously, jobs should be lost. They should be lost at the upper management level. That's the reason why you merge, because you realize that one section the management is not working, or worse, that they're actually making the problem worse. So you get rid of them, and you merge it in with somebody who's doing a much better job, and you increase their responsibilities. That's really the way mergers and acquisitions work in the real world. But unfortunately, we're talking about the Indian public sector. So on one hand, it does look like this step in the right direction, but then the question is, if no jobs are going to be lost, then why? How does that, I understand that it might transfer bad debts from this book to that book, where it will be absorbed by the loss of the more successful guys. So in one way, is the more successful banks, or the more honest banks, I would say, are going to subsidize the risk taking of the worst banks. And that's the bad thing. That's not the way things should happen. I understand that it might be the most pragmatic thing to happen, because ultimately we have to get those off the books. But the real thing, but I'm perfectly fine with that happening as a matter of pragmatics, but also there needs to be accountability for the guys who took those decisions. And because this is government, that is not going to happen, which kind of defeats the very purpose of this bank merger. Now, there's another thing that I wanted to bring up, because I saw it being brought up, was that people said that, the manufacturing section. And by the way, because of the problem that we have with liquidity, you have things like, people not buying cars, for instance. That's pretty obvious that, real estate, cars, things that even normal people need credit for, they just can't put cash down and buy, that the sales of those are going to suffer. And the thing is, these things have a multiplier effect. So if a car dealership is not able to, let's say 5% of their inventory, immediately the car dealership is going to say, well, we're not going to take any more delivery of anything at this point of time, because our lots are full. We're not selling cars, and we are paying our, we're paying our salespeople. So the moment they do that, they stop taking orders. And so that 5% essentially translates to a 10% cut for the distributor. And now it flows back, and the people who are manufacturing it, for whom stopping the manufacturing plant actually costs way, way more. So if an automotive plant, you know, stopping is huge. But then you have a surplus of cars which are collecting at the factory itself. So then they will have to stop the factory line. So once they stop the factory line, two things happen. One is losses in the millions per day because the factory line is stopped. And then they start letting go of people. So, you know, a small 5% delta in demand at the point of sale might go to 30% at the destination. So it kind of explodes. And so that's why when sales of cars drop or when sales of real estate drop, you know that this is the tip of the iceberg. That the real effect is, first of all, it's going to take some time to flow through the economy and it will be felt somewhere else. Which brings me to another thing that, you know, again, as people were, you know, of course, critics of the government were all, again, blaming it on GST and compliance. They're saying, you know, the compliance regime needed for GST is breaking companies. Well, the thing with this is that ultimately, and this happens in the US, is that companies have to invest and they have to pass the cost on to the customers, by the way, have to invest in compliance functions. So in India, at least my limited experience is that, at least for smaller shops, there isn't a compliance function. For smaller businesses, there isn't a compliance function. And now what GST is doing, it's making everybody have a compliance function, which is, by the way, pretty standard in the US. Everybody has a compliance function because there's a lot of paperwork that INS requires from you. There's a lot of paperwork that local authorities require from you. I mean, even as an individual, there's so much paperwork. For instance, I stay in California, right? So this might be an extreme case. But there's a lot of compliance. For instance, you know, of our vehicles, we have to, you know, we have to, for every 2 years, we have to, every year for old cars, 2 years, I think, for new cars, you have to get smog check and everything. And if you don't pass, then it brings along a lot of other things with it. So for an individual, that kind of adds up because you can't go to work on those days. So there are compliance costs that are imposed. And for the individual, there's really nothing we can do to pass it along, but businesses have the option to pass it along to their customers. And a complicated scheme like GST obviously imposes this. There's no doubt about it that it has imposed a compliance cost, and that compliance cost ultimately needs to be passed down to the customer. The businesses cannot, should not try to absorb it. They will obviously have to absorb a little bit of it or perhaps some part of it, but ultimately it'll have to come down to the customer. Now, another thing that I noticed in some of the discussions where people were saying that, you know, India is doing badly is because India is because of the Modi government, because not other countries are not doing badly. Look at Bangladesh. First of all, Bangladesh, again, it has a lower base than India. Second is that this is a problem with manufacturing. So India, China has been doing very well in manufacturing and Bangladesh has been doing very well in manufacturing. But the thing with manufacturing is that I remember a long time ago, my dad said something about on these lines, which I think is perfect. He said, this was before Bangladesh became kind of a manufacturing hub and it was really China. And people were saying, you know, why can't India do this? And my dad said, well, the thing is that China has an advantage that India doesn't have, that China doesn't have to put up with communists. And that is exactly true, because manufacturing excellence is essentially intrinsically tied to labor exploitation. The only way you can succeed in global manufacturing is by a race to the bottom. And it happens because of that. That's why in the US, manufacturing jobs did move to Mexico. They moved to places where there are not as strong workers' rights. There are not so much environmental restrictions. That's what Trump keeps on saying, right? He keeps on saying the way to get back jobs to the US is essentially trample on workers' rights, not to have a minimum wage, you know, to weaken environmental regulations. So that is the way of getting jobs back. That is the way of getting manufacturing jobs back. Classical manufacturing jobs, you know, assembling things that sell in the dollar store, for instance, they are based on essentially making the production cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. And the only way you can do it, there are two ways you can do it. One is through technology and automation, which brings with it job loss. And the other way, then the easier way, I would say, is labor exploitation. And Bangladesh is notorious for sweatshops. India just cannot do it because of the exact same people who are criticizing the government. They themselves will not allow it to be done. Bangladesh has an atrocious labor record, and other countries which are doing even better in manufacturing now, like Vietnam, and you know, they don't have that. They don't have the protections. And it's not that India has great labor protections, by the way, either. But India still has a democratic working, you know, a working democracy, which brings some kind of checks and balances. Which again, the rights of the Americans, let me just use America as an example. I mean, America used to be a manufacturing hub at some point of time. You know, cars and everything were made here. And then what happened was that during the 60s and the 70s, when US was at its height of its economic power in the world, because it was in a race with the USSR, which was obviously ostensibly about workers' rights, but again, their people worked in the gulag-like conditions, just like they do in China, the US, in order to show, you know, essentially to show that we are, you know, a nation of which is better than the Russia, the people who were working in manufacturing were able to get the kind of negotiation powers. It was much more unionized. They got some of the sweetest deals that you could imagine in the 60s and 70s for themselves. So unions were extremely powerful, and they negotiated, you know, great packages for their workers, which was going to last for all eternity. And recently, in the 2000s, many of the older US companies, whether it be United Airlines, whether it be Ford, whether it was GM, what they did was they had to renegotiate. They called it their legacy costs. Essentially, all the stuff they agreed to in during the roaring 60s and the 70s, they had to renegotiate those with the unions because they just could not pay them. So this is around the 80s was when, late 70s and 80s was when the manufacturing jobs began to move out of US. Because they just, because of politics, because of the deal that the unions had struck. You know, in India, we grew up thinking, because, you know, I was growing up in West Bengal, that America is all about exploitation of labor while Russia isn't. Obviously, that is nothing close to the truth. It's absolutely the other way around, by the way. And that's why, and the proof of is that, proof of it is that jobs went out from the US to places like Mexico, to places like Costa Rica, to places in South America. And many went to China, for instance, because there was no human rights in China. They could, you know, if you've seen documentaries, you've seen the kind of conditions, the Chinese labor, the people who are putting your iPhones together, the kind of conditions they work in. And they continue to work in that because they don't have a democratic process of redress, because the Chinese government is complicit in that exploitation. Now, that cannot happen and should not happen in India. I strongly believe that it should not happen, that labor exploitation is something which cannot persist. So I'm not concerned. I personally don't think that it's even good that India even looks at other places and say we want to be a manufacturing hub. We cannot be a manufacturing hub of things. Most things are, you know, things that you manufacture are essentially low cost items at this point of time, whether they're all commodities, whether it be cars, whether it be, you know, of course, you can also talk about software as something which is manufactured, right? It's developed, but that there's an intellectual concept. It's an intellectual part of it. It's not exploitative. People get paid well. And I think the software industry actually grew by a significant portion, if I'm not wrong, this quarter. So it's not that India is getting these things wrong. Again, there are some sectors which is doing well. It's very obvious why. And there are some sectors because of the liquidity crisis in which they're not doing well. So this is, again, my personal perspective based on my understanding. I will, of course, what's going to happen is my dad is going to listen to this podcast and he's going to send me an email.
Speaking of that, by the way, we did have one, a couple of people asking this on WhatsApp. So they wanted to ask this at the end of the podcast, but since you brought it up, so they wanted to know that did your parents listen to last week's podcast? And if so, did you receive any blowback for some of the things that you said?
Blowback for what exactly did I say in my podcast last time?
You mentioned some things about your parents being overprotective and you also mentioned that they would be listening to this podcast. So a couple of people seemed to be quite curious about
You know, my mother actually wrote saying that she's okay that, you know, she's okay with what I said. And it's okay that I didn't need to apologize for wanting to have to leave my parents' place. That it's okay. That, you know, it's something which all of us feel. So it's, there's nothing to be apologetic about.
And
understanding. So I think she understands, and I in advance understand why my daughter would also want to move out. I mean, nowadays, of course, now she says, I'll never leave. I'll always stay here. But as I tell my wife, of course, she will leave. And I want her to leave also, because I know that, you know, it's essential for her to grow as a human being, to, you know, see the world, make her own mistakes on her own.
Absolutely.
And know that, you know, I am here. We'll always be here. But we're always here as like level 2 technical support. We're not here as level 1. So level 1 stuff you have to resolve on your own. Otherwise, you'll never be able to become level 2 customer support on your own when you have your own kids, right? So that's never going to happen. So there's a line at which you have to, you know, say, now is the time to move on. So I took that decision myself. I don't think my parents were emotionally in that place to, you know, cut that cord. So I had to take it myself. But yeah, I don't think my parents kind of objected to that at all. But as I said, my parents are understanding parents. You know, they're understanding in many ways. They're not understanding in a few others also.
Right.
We'll definitely not go there.
Right. And of course, now of course we are winding down to cricket. I have not been watching this, by the way, because for once I think the timing suits you, and it's overnight.
The problem is with India West Indies series is they're nowhere close to what they used to be. I mean, again, West Indies is a very decent one day and T20 side, but you know, test cricket they obviously, you know, they're barely test grade now, but still it's still a series in West Indies where it's their conditions, and it's been exhilarating to watch Indian pace bowlers give to West Indies at places like Sabina Park, where they would literally floor their opponents. I think Malcolm Marshall, I think, who broke the ridge of Mike Gatting's nose. When the ball came out, there were like bits of fragments of his bone stuck in the seam.
Yikes.
So that was the level at which, I mean, it was not just losing your wicket, it was the very real prospect of losing your life or definitely losing a limb. And to watch Bumrah today just blasting out West Indies batsmen. Again, these are not the Haynes and the Richards and the Greenidges of yore, definitely, but they're still wearing West Indies colors. And just to see an Indian pace bowler, you know, and of course, there's a gentle joy of watching Ishant Sharma score runs. But other than that, I think Indian cricket has come a long way where we're going to a place which is not Sri Lanka, and where we go and score 441 runs and the other team is like 84 for 7. This never used to happen before. And because we never had the bowlers for it. Now we have... Now, it's not just whenever anybody does well, and Bumrah had an exceptional day today, it's not just that guy. It's also the other people who are keeping the pressure up and other. And I think Shami was bowling very well today too. So, I think it's for those of us who are old enough to remember the India going to the West Indies and getting decimated in the 80s. This is sweet revenge.
Just a word about Bumrah. Yeah, I did read about the fact that he was on a hat-trick and he still didn't go for the review. And you mentioned at a few episodes back during the World Cup about his attitude, where you saw him as somebody who kept his composure. That again reflected in this, right? I mean, he was on a hat-trick, but still.
I really like that about Bumrah. He's very, very, you know, he's very grounded in many ways. So I think that he has what I believe. I mean, there's some people who...
Kind of a zen.
For who he's able to maintain a level of detachment from the proceedings that are going around him. And of course, there is a need for passion, and but there is also the risk that the passion becomes all-consuming, like it happens to Virat Kohli, that he doesn't seem to be a person who is in control, that he's letting his emotions run the show. So you need people like, for instance, like Dhoni. I think his biggest capability. That Dhoni always, there was a detachment. I mean, this was the first time we saw it. Again, Ganguly didn't have that detachment. So I remember, you know, one of the first things I remembered about Dhoni's captaincy was when he wins, he doesn't run with the stumps. He first looks around, sees if he's won, goes and shakes the hand of the umpire,
And he takes it as the end of the game. It's not that he takes the stump and starts running. Other people are taking the stump and starting running, but he's being the adult. And that is so essential for a captain. And which is why I believe that, you know, I don't know. Normally, bowlers don't become captains. But if he continues this kind of form, I think that Bumrah should definitely be considered someday to be a captain. I tweeted that, you know, how long will it take before he's considered to be the greatest of all time, fast bowler that India's ever had? And again, of course, it's too early, but you know, let him, if he's able to maintain this for, I think, 2 years, which is a lot of cricket nowadays, by the way, then again, in India, we haven't had really great pace bowler with respect to Kapil Dev. I think the Kapil Dev's main thing wasn't a great pace bowler. But given the context, given that the other guy opening the bowling was Sunil Gavaskar, he was obviously that. That is where the greatness came in. And also the fact that he was a brilliant batsman. I think he was a way better batsman than he was a bowler. He didn't do justice to his batting. He was a much better batsman than Imran Khan, much better batsman than Hadley, much better batsman than Ian Botham. He was just an amazing batsman. The testament, and this might be before your time, was I had seen him bat Eden Gardens Test 1983. Where it was a juiced up Eden pitch in December. December juiced up pitch with this mist in Eden Gardens. It's like the worst of England. And the pitch was green, kind of. I was in the ground. So, you know, those days were not days of color television. So you wouldn't be able to make out if you're watching it on TV, but in the ground you could see it was green. And Gavaskar was out the first ball. And I remember watching Anshuman Gaikwad getting out. His bat was actually on the way up when the ball hit his stump. You can't make out that temporal difference on television. Those days, definitely not, where television coverage was also crappy. But in the ground, you could feel. I watched that game in the ground. And when Michael Holding was coming into bowl, you couldn't hear him. He was that silent. But when Malcolm Marshall was coming into bowl, you know, there was the 100,000 people in the ground, and you could hear the thump of his thump, 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 thump. You know, that guy, you could feel the power of this guy coming into bowl. And he would come into bowl, it would be like a steam engine. You know, his hands moving like a steam engine. It was like a perfectly tuned steam engine coming into bowl. I mean, each of these West Indian pace bowlers had their own style of bowling. Holding, Marshall, Andy Roberts was kind of over the hill. He was on the end, but Marshall was at his height, which is obviously unbelievable. And on that day, remember Kapil Dev came in and he just blasted those guys to all parts of the park. They were bowling, the conditions were exactly the same, but you just couldn't, you know, it was like watching these guys were batting on one pitch and Kapil Dev was batting on another pitch. I mean, the kind of that pace, the kind of shots he was playing, it's unbelievable. Again, Kapil Dev's bowling, I was not a huge fan of that, honestly. But his batting is a brilliant batsman. Again, one last thing was, you know, have you seen Rakeem Cornwall? So in this day and age,
NBA
to see Rakeem Cornwall just makes me so happy. You know, I can relate to cricketers once again. And, you know, this guy, I don't know if you've seen, but you should see Rakeem Cornwall in some of the T20 games he plays in West Indies. So he's this huge hitter. He's like Yusuf Pathan.
Right.
And what happens is he hits and then he stops running after some time. So there was this game in which what he did was, he was like, I don't know, the video is on YouTube, you can check it out. But he was hitting, like he made like 75 or something in 30 balls. And then after some time, he just, like, it was hot and stuff and he wasn't running. He stopped running. And then he decided, like Inzamam of old, that he's going to retire hurt and he's going to come back later. As he's walking out, Kyron Pollard comes up and starts abusing him. Like he walks and Kyron Pollard is like... He's like giving him gullies. You can just see it. You know, saying, basically pointing in, you know, his finger is right at his face, basically saying that you can't just walk out. You have to stay and bat.
This is a T20, right?
T20. So he's supremely unfit. But man, when he hits it, it just flies. It just flies. He's actually, again, I don't think he would be,
he would be a great buy for IPL, but I don't think that, you know, coaches and stuff with his fitness and things, I mean, he stands in slip, right? But he's that good, even in this day and age, that he can get into the side as a spinner and as a batsman. I mean, he's basically an unfit version of, I would say, an unfit version of Andre Russell. So I don't think he has a future in this day and age where, you know, you have to pass the yo-yo test. And I don't think that he'll pass the yo-yo test. The likelihood of him passing yo-yo test is about the same as the likelihood of, say, Rahul Gandhi solving, you know, exercises in Nidorov. So I don't think any of that is going to happen. But I
PSL star, maybe.
But he's a very good player. Actually, I like watching him bat. You know, he's actually supremely talented. Just to think that in this day and age that he's made it to the national side, he doesn't look like a professional cricket player in 2019, right? But he's that good. Actually, he's actually a pretty decent bowler. If you saw him bowling, he got 3 wickets on this pitch, and he was making the ball spin. So he's a good spinner. He's still not out. He's playing very defensively now. But if he wants, he can really hit this guy.
Okay.
All right.
I think we started with food and politics, spoke about economy, and ended up with cricket. But I think that's our podcast for today.
Yes.
And I mentioned earlier that we had a couple of questions coming through WhatsApp. So you can do that too. You can send in your questions to 96525-78833. Add a +91 if you're outside India. And I'll ask your questions to Arnab whenever I can. And of course, the Patreon. Arnab has a Patreon page. You can go to patreon.com/greatbong and show Arnab that you care in the best way you can by pledging an amount. That's pretty much it for this week. And we'll see you around next time. Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay. Take care. Thank you.